You are listening to Walking Home from the ICU. We will be exploring how to save and preserve lives in the ICU. All opinions and views shared are unaffiliated with any organization. Okay, welcome back. I need to apologize to those that have tried to access the website for webinars and consulting services. It temporarily went down to repair some malware and is now back up. So it is www.criticalcareconsultant.net. There are some really exciting episodes coming up, diving into more research, protocols, and even the financial picture of avoiding sedation and maximizing mobility. I am routinely going to be bringing it back to the survivors to make sure we don't get lost and lose sight of our why. Let's always be humble and compassionate enough to seek out the perspective and wisdom of those that have and continue to live the price of deep sedation and immobility. Today, I bring on physiotherapist, sedation and delirium survivor, and now author, Aaron Welsh. Aaron, I'm so excited to have you on the show. Can you introduce yourself to us?
Hi, my name's Aaron, and I am a ICU survivor.
And tell us a little bit about what brought you to the ICU and how that went down.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, I was quite happily doing a little bit of gardening on a beautiful summer's day, and I got the most tiny cut on the back of my hand, which became a little bit sore, became a little bit red, became a little bit infected. And at the end of the day, I just kind of sat down with my partner and we were having a nice glass of wine, watching the summer sun go down. And it just looked a little bit red and I was having a little bit of a scratch of it. And she said, you know, that looks sore, leave it alone. And ignored it, as you do when you also have a fairly minor injury. And went to bed. And then I woke up in the middle of the night and my arm was just really hugely swollen, but at the time I didn't really have any symptoms. And we went to accident and emergency, and my medical condition deteriorated very, very rapidly. I went from being, you know, just kind of a little bit concerned because my arm was swollen, to I started to fit. I started having seizures. I was drifting in and out of consciousness due to the pain, and then the decision was made that I had a severe infection, which turned out to be necrotizing fasciitis, which is commonly known as the flesh-eating superbug, for very good reasons. And I was taken to theaters and I was put into a medically induced coma, apparently to help me recover. But as I think happens with a surprising number of people, it surprised me because I'm not completely medically ignorant. I studied physiotherapy and I've worked in intensive care. And, you know, like most people, I've kind of sat and seen people in a medically induced coma and kind of wondered, you know, what level of consciousness, are you aware of anything? And I was very, very aware of things, but unfortunately, you know, I had a severe case of intensive care psychosis, intensive care delirium, whichever term you prefer. And I was basically catapulted into a series of the most horrendous and vivid nightmare. Well, I'm reluctant to use the word nightmare in absence of a better description of what they were. Because a nightmare, I think, suggests a bad dream. And we're all familiar with what a nightmare or a bad dream is. But, you know, if you want to have an understanding of how vivid and real these were, what you need to do is just look around wherever you're listening to this. So if you're listening to this in your living room, just look around your living room. And the clarity and detail was as clear as what you're seeing now. Unfortunately, it is also the most horrific and terrifying hallucinations and delusions that that you can possibly imagine. I have kind of sat back on and thought to myself, how was my imagination able to conjure up these things? I know I'm talking, I'm kind of getting quite deep about it, but it's only by want of a better way of expressing the how terrifying it was. It was a truly terrifying experience.
And you mention it in this book that you've just written. Mm-hmm. You've gone through some of the specific images or scenarios that you, again, yeah. I don't want to use the word imagined. Let's just say that you lived these scenarios. Tell us a little bit about what exactly you experienced.
Okay. It was, yeah, you hit on a really good point there, because when I was writing the book, I really struggled with ways of how I would describe these different experiences is how I would call it. And the reason why I say an experience is because when you have an experience, it is real to you. And an experience that you have comes with not just what you see, feel, and hear, but also the emotions that is attached to it. And also when you remember something that you've done, so if you remember something that, you know, a really happy and pleasant experience that you've had, the emotions that are attached to that come flooded back with it. And it's exactly the same with that, because you when you look back on it, you could still feel the visceral fear that they were. So in the book, I describe several of these kind of, I described several of them. And if anybody just take the time to read the book, you will come away thinking, gosh, that does sound absolutely horrific. But I have to also point out that I edited some of them and didn't put some of them in, because I was worried that it would upset people by reading them. And when I describe a couple of them, you have to think, well, gosh, what were these other ones that he left out? So the first one that I was aware of, it was kind of pretty much as soon as I was sedated, but when I was prepped for theatres. And I'm assuming that it was while I was being intubated, because one thing that happened and one thing that was constant through it, my brain was basically trying to explain what was happening to my body. That's kind of part of what your experience is. And because my brain couldn't, you know, understand the fact that I was being intubated on an intubation tube, my brain just sort of went, okay, we need to explain what this is. And it decided to conjure up the image of a snake, which was kind of inhabiting my airway. And I remember vividly, and I'm just closing my eyes now and remembering the feeling of its head pushing against my lips and pushing past my teeth, and it working its way down into the back of my throat. And it kind of making its way down through my airway. And I can still feel, if I close my eyes, so I do try not to do this too often, but I can feel it breathing. I can feel its muscles contracting, flexing and contracting, and flexing and relaxing rather. And the feeling of it against, you know, my trachea, I can still feel that if I close my eyes and concentrate. So that was kind of the first thing. I think because I was so heavily sedated, the ITU staff there, you know, if I'd have been and got there 20 minutes later, I would have died without doubt. You know, so they did save my life, but there were things that were definitely missed with me. And I think first of all, the pain control, because I was so heavily sedated, they didn't know how well my pain control was. So the first scenario that I was in, I was kind of floating in a sort of an electronic universe with, you know, very vivid, very bright colors and shapes kind of popping all around me. And I had kind of I was surrounded by kind of spikes, which I could feel penetrating my skin and into my flesh, thousands of them kind of rhythmically entering my body. And this went on for what, you know, one of the things that happens to Liam is time warps. And I was kind of in this bizarre, very painful world for, I don't know, probably about 4 or 5 days, I would imagine. That's how it felt. And then I was on the ward and I kind of moved through different scenarios. Have we got time for me to just kind of talk about them a little bit?
Yeah, no, I think that'd be great.
Okay. I'm ex-military, and I think everybody comes to, unfortunately, everybody who has kind of an experience of this, and certainly through talking to other survivors, you all take your own kind of, your own personal experiences into your coma with you. And I'm ex-military. So a number of my experiences that I had were linked to things that I'd seen in active service. I was kind of revisited. One of the experiences that kind of stuck in my head when I was in the military, and that was a child who had a shrapnel injury to her head, and she's been held by her mother. And I kind of relived that. And the guilt of not being able to do something at that time was revisited on me with, you know, the volume level of all that emotion was cranked right up. And it didn't stop. It just went on and went on and went on. And I think, you know, if you like a lot of soldiers, I think, who've seen active service, you can carry a certain amount of guilt around with you in that, you know, was it the just thing? Was it the right thing to do? And that was kind of served up to me, feelings of guilt, where I find myself, I was a giant, and I was on this kind of, the whole of the was laid flat a little bit like an atlas. And I was a giant standing on this atlas. But I could see every human being on the planet. But I could see all their faces. And they were all pointing at me. And they were saying, it's your fault. Not that I'd done that things, but everything was my fault. And I could hear simultaneously, I know it sounds incredible, but, you know, this is the power of the brain. It's your fault. It's your fault. And they were shouting things that happened to people, things that have happened to humanity, but it was all my fault. And I distinctly remember, a tiny, tiny little Jewish man shouting at me, the Holocaust was your fault. And a woman shouting, my daughter was raped and it was your fault. My cancer is your fault. And I could hear every single person on the planet shouting these things at me. And I could feel the guilt that you would feel if you had that leveled at you. And that went on for days in my head. Standing there with every person on the planet shouting at me. I know I'm kind of laughing now when I say it, but it's because it does sound so absurd, but that that doesn't make sense. But yeah, I did. And one of the other one of the more difficult ones, because when I started to become a little bit more medically stable, and I had visitors, I think they may have lowered my station because I had an awareness of people visiting me, and my brothers, one older and one younger, had come to visit me. If you have a sensitive disposition, this might be a time to like turn the podcast down for a few moments, because this is not very nice to hear. So I obviously had an awareness of my two brothers being near me. So my brain took this information and said, right, okay, your brothers are in distress. Why are they in distress? And then it made a scenario. And I was floating probably about 20 feet in the air above a kind of arid kind of desert landscape. Underneath me were my two brothers, but not just my two brothers. They were copies of them. So there was my two brothers, but probably about 100 of one and about 100 of the other. And they were naked. And as I was looking down at them, their arms and legs would be pulled away as if they were attached to, I don't know, four horses. And I watched and remember the detail was as real as what you're seeing right now in your living rooms. And I watched their arms and legs pulled from the sockets and then screaming in agony and looking at me, kind of in a help me do something kind of way. And then their abdomen would rip open and their intestines and their internal organs would kind of spill out. And they were still alive and looking at me into my eyes. And then their heads would kind of stretch back and the tissue at the front of the neck and sinews would just rip open and their heads would be pulled off. And then there was a little puff of smoke and they vanished. And then there was another puff of smoke and a new one would appear and that would be repeated. And there were, this was hundreds of my brothers or copies of them underneath me. And that played out in my head for 4 days, four solid days. I floated and watched my brothers been eviscerated. You're a little bit lost in words.
I mean, what can you say to that? I mean, it's hard to fathom imagining that. I think we all know what it's like to wake up from a bad dream and to take a split second to reorient ourselves and to recognize, oh, okay, that was just a dream. But maybe those dreams lasted 20 minutes.
Hmm.
But you're talking about
more days and nights.
Actual reality to you.
Yeah.
Days and nights. Clearly, you've written this down, you've told this story, you've worked through this. I think a lot of survivors, even that we've interviewed, aren't able to go this explicit because this is real trauma. This is why people have PTSD.
Yeah.
It's so hard to talk about. And I'm so grateful that you are able to and willing to.
But you know why? I am talking about this, you know, and I've written it down in a book. So, you know, it's not something that I'm kind of feeling any guilt or shame of, but it isn't easy to talk about, but I am talking about this in an attempt to stop other people having similar experiences. If people like me, survivors, don't say, guys, this is what happened, not to all of us, but this is what is happening to some people right now in this department of 10 in ITU, 10 bedded ITU department, 50% of them or more are experiencing something similar to that right now.
And COVID's kind of exposing that, right? We're calling it COVID brain, the long haulers, which I'm sure has a lot to do with COVID, but also we've given people the deepest comas with the worst benzodiazepines, right? And so finally, in the masses and people, and now we have social media and we're all connected more, people are starting to talk about this. But the ironic and terrible thing is that we give sedation to prevent pain and fear. We think that we're going to prevent PTSD. We think that we're sparing patients the horrific reality of the ICU by making them, quote unquote, sleep. We think that they'd be in too much pain and terror and discomfort to be awake on the ventilator. And yet in your book, you talk about all you experienced was pain and fear.
Yeah, I can get that, you know, the idea of being, especially, you know, if you're confused because of sepsis or things like that. So I get that, you know, the ITU ward could be a little bit of a, a difficult thing to deal with. But I think if you're not completely sedated, then there are ways of dealing with that. I cannot imagine being anywhere as terrifying as I was. So if you're going to give me a choice of being where I was, or, you know, kind of trying to fathom the fact that and get my head around the fact that I'm in an ITU ward, my arm is the size of a, you know, an NFL player's thigh, and I've got a breathing tube down my neck, and I'm still trying to get all those pieces of a jigsaw together, then there is no way you can tell me that is worse than 4 days watching your brother's been eviscerated. It's just not. And I won't, you know, and I can't believe that. And if departments don't know that that's what's happening to some people. Okay. I get that everyone's an individual. Every patient is an individual. And maybe I did need a level of sedation, but it seems to me that it was right. It needs to date him, and they dropped me like a stone into sedation. And I think maybe a better way of doing it would be to give me some sedation and see how I tolerated my environment. You know, at least then I would have been able to, you know, enter discourse about the level of pain that I was in. Because even though they sedated me in a way to stop me from feeling, you know, the fear of being in an intensive care unit, it didn't have any impact on the pain. Pain was constant throughout the whole of my experience.
But you didn't know where the pain came from. And you talk about that in your book.
Yeah.
How much, theoretically, no way to go back and know, right?
Yeah.
But you misconstrued your pain and the source of your pain the whole time. How much would it have helped to have known where your pain was coming from, why it was happening, and how the coping mechanisms to work through it, or connect with Karen at your bedside to help bring solace and comfort during that painful experience?
Yeah, I used to be a physiotherapist, or as you call, physical therapist, and I've worked in intensive care, but I've also, you know, and I didn't know about any of this, but I've also worked in chronic pain management, and I understand that the pain experience, pain is hugely influenced by, you know, the context in which you feel it. And, you know, the example I give is, you know, if pain, childbirth is very, very painful, I understand. And, you know, that's as far as I can say, being a man. And if it was so painful, but the result and the outcome and the context wasn't such positive and a beautiful thing, then women would only have one child, because there's no way you would want to go through that again. But because the context of it, you can understand, women will prepare to go on to have two or more children because it's context. And I had no context for my pain. I just was pain. When I was sedated, I didn't have any understanding that I was sick and I was in hospital and I was having multiple operations on my arm. I just felt pain without context. If I was able to kind of have some awareness of, okay, I'm sick, I'm in hospital, then that gives your brain a chance to catch up a little bit with the pain and say, okay, calm yourself down, dude. You're in pain because look to your right. You don't understand why, but your arm's covered in bandages. There's obviously something wrong. You start to dial back the pain because you understand what it is and why you're experiencing it. But if you rob somebody of any ability to develop a relationship with their injury, then all you are is pain. And that's all I was. You know, there were periods where I just was pain. And that sounds melodramatic, but
no, it's that was your truth. That was your reality.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah.
And so the irony just, it's painful because we have done this for decades with the understanding that we're sparing people fear and pain. And that's exactly what it was, what you were sent into. I also believe that we're much more likely to more appropriately treat pain with adequate narcotics or less narcotics potentially. If we can ask a patient if they're in pain. And you were severely septic. You had septic shock, which is a huge risk factor for delirium. So even in the wake and walking ICU, I mean, it's a lot of times it just seems like a sepsis unit because there's a lot of sepsis going on. So you're already at high risk of developing delirium. A lot of patients in the wake and walking ICU that are delirious, yes, they can be agitated and moving around, but sepsis just takes it out of you ultimately, right? You're just so inflamed, so sick that a lot of times these patients in the wake and walking ICU, you have to have a sitter with them, families at the bedside, but they don't, we went over 2 years without any self-extubations. So I can't think of scenarios in which we've sedated people for sepsis. And I think that's important because you came in as a high risk of having delirium and you were given medications that cause delirium. We don't do that with kidneys. We look at, you know, a creatinine and then we say, wow, they're developing a kidney injury. We better look at the vancomycin and adjust the dose. We better, I mean, we have, and now it seems silly, but we had all this controversy over IV contrast for CT scans, right? Now we know that it's not so injurious to the kidneys, but that was one of our big concerns. Well, their kidneys are injured or at risk of having an injury because they're in septic shock. So we better not give something that will hurt their kidneys. But when it comes to the brain, we've done the complete opposite. We have someone that comes in severely septic and we say, wow, they're, instead of saying, wow, they're at risk of developing delirium, we better avoid medications that cause delirium and brain injury and cognitive deficit and post-ICU PTSD. We do the opposite. We say, wow, they're really sick. We better give them things that will hurt their brain more.
And, you know, I cannot think of an example in medicine where, you know, or in physiotherapy where you would do that with any other condition. The reason I can't think of another one, we'd say, okay, this is what's wrong with them. We will give them something that will exacerbate that massively. I can't think of one.
I don't think there is. It defies logic, right? But to be able to apply that knowledge or that logic, we have to understand the reality of it. And only survivor voices will really provide us the truth about what our interventions cause in the ICU in that moment and then afterward. And it's powerful to hear your perspective as a veteran. We interviewed Paul a few episodes ago talking about delirium in veterans. And there are so many of you out there. And I've had anything, ironic thing is that on these online discussions, people have said, well, our patients have PTSD. Well, we have veterans. And I want to just grab them by the shoulders and say, yes, yes, I'm glad you care about that. Let's talk about the reality of that. Why would we say everyone has their own experiences they're carrying into the ICU with them? Everyone has their own trauma that they're carrying into with them. PTSD is part of the medical history. We should deeply care about that when we're considering causing people to be delirious. What would you have the ICU community understand about veterans? I mean, what you've experienced was horrific the first time. Why would we want people to experience it again?
Yeah, I mean, I think it naturally predisposes, you know, if you put them in a delirium situation, it naturally predisposes them to have a worse time. And, you know, the brain mechanism which causes PTSD is already lined up. Now, how well that's been treated in the past, you know, I mean, they could have had excellent treatment in the past and, you know, and not really have a huge amount of issues that or challenges that they're dealing with. But the furrow is already been laid. So it doesn't take that much to set that process off again. I mean, certainly it didn't with me. I mean, you know, it was a track I was put straight back on. So I think, you know, it's something that that particularly with veterans, they need to be massively aware of and have a sensitivity towards, you know, and think, ah, right, okay, if we put this guy under, or this girl under, you know, deep sedation with medications that we know are likely to cause delirium, then there is inevitable outcome to that, and that outcome is going to be either an exacerbation of PTSD, or it's going to rear its head again, and they're going to experience it, and they're going to experience it a lot quicker and a lot harder. I think the IT units need to be aware of that, and I don't remember it even being considered with me at any point. And I have. The fact that my military history may have some sort of bearing, the fact that I was a veteran, it was never discussed. And it's not like I turned up at a hospital as John Doe. You know, Karen was there and knew my history. It wouldn't have taken, you know, it's, I don't know, maybe it's something that, you know, when they're looking at, you know, moving somebody into an ITU bed and starting to make a decision about if they're going to sedate, and if so, what level of sedation they're going to give them, then maybe they should be thinking about making that one of the questions that they start asking family and friends. Because, you know, if they have, you know, this guy's a veteran, right, okay, has he had any counselling? Has he had any problems in the past? And, you know, if there's a slightest doubt of, you know, the possibility that it's there, then, you know, they want to be damn sure what they're doing first.
I wonder, because you talk about the experience, we'll call it that, the experience of seeing the child with a shrapnel injury to their head in a mother's arms, and the guilt of having to leave them there. And then was it directly after that you go into this scenario of having everyone in the world blame you for their sorrows? That kind of guilt, that screams PTSD, not just like the imagery, but the feelings of how real that was. That deep emotional pain that we don't want anyone to experience. And
that emotional pain was visceral. That emotional pain was, it caused a physical pain. It was that wrenching inside.
And you make such a strong point that you would have rather have known that you were critically ill in the ICU than to have felt that.
I would rather have been anywhere doing anything than have done that. Now, it's happened to me and I can't turn the clock back. In all honesty, I wouldn't, because I'm going to, you know, do my best to make sure people hear my voice so this doesn't happen to other people. But, you know, right then and there, if you would have given me a choice of being literally anywhere than having that experience, there's no way the ITU is that bad that you would prefer that to.
When we first started talking, you said that if someone were to invite you, give you two options of being in a medically induced coma or having your feet in the fire, you were ready to start taking your socks off.
Oh, God, all day long. Yeah. And that's not, you know, that isn't hubris. It was that bad that I would have preferred that.
Aaron, people, especially on the nursing side, say all the time, you better give me all the medications. You better knock me out if I have the ventilator down my the tube down my throat.
Do they really?
No, that is the common consensus. Because all that
is a bold statement.
Right. Coming from complete ignorance, right? They have never had those personal experiences, or they've only been sedated for, you know, maybe a day and not gone into full delirium.
But the day thing, it doesn't, because time warps. You know, a day can be long. A day is not a day down there. It's kind of, you know, like the movie Inception, where the lower they go, the more time. That's real. That's real when you state it. But you're right. If they knew what it was like down there, or can be like down there. I mean, again, you know, I may have had I don't know. I don't know whether my experience was worse than other people. I know I'm probably more vocal about it, and I'm probably more vocal about it because I do have a medical background. I do have a certain amount of agency, and I don't want other people to go through what I did. And you mentioned COVID earlier. And the COVID page, it was that really kind of that, you know, I was writing this down anyway as kind of a therapeutic cathartic exercise. But, you know, it wasn't really until I saw the ITU beds filling up with COVID patients that I thought, this is a mental health time bomb waiting to go off in society. I mean, well, you know, certainly in the UK, you know, mental health problems have gone through the roof purely on the back of people being locked in their houses all day long. Now you've got these guys like me who've been locked in their brain in an ICU bed for, you know, for weeks on end. See how they're going to cope in, you know, in a few months. That's why I wrote the book.
And we have no support for them. We put them in delirium for weeks. We take away their ability to stand, walk, talk, swallow. And then we send them to rehabilitation or LTAC, and we give them no heads up that they've had delirium, that they may suffer from post-ICU PTSD, post-ICU dementia, that their lives will never be the same again. What kind of resources or education did you receive before you discharged home?
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. I came out and I thought I had lost my mind because I didn't know why I'd gone through what I had. I was still going through it. I thought, literally thought I'd lost my mind. And it wasn't until I started communicating with people in different support groups. And, you know, I was like, okay, this is a thing. This isn't me. I have not lost my mind. It's a thing that I'm going through. And lots of other people, and, you know, I was hearing the stories and they were like, kind of, okay, the scenario was different. The geography was different, but it was largely the same. You know, the stories that I heard of, you know, when she was in an ITU bed and they were catheterizing her, she thought she was being violently raped repeatedly. So yeah, I've lost my train of thought.
That is what people report, and I think they feel safer to talk about it amongst other survivors. People talk about they go home and they try to tell their families and their families kind of shrug it off. They say, well, no, that didn't happen, so get over it. I saw you were just in the ICU bed, so it didn't happen, so it doesn't matter.
But also with a lot of that, you know, you've got to remember that a lot of these family members have stood vigil by somebody's bed for days, weeks, sometimes even months on end, and they've got you home. Jeez, they're just happy you made it. You know what I mean? If they've stood there and watched you, oh, he's going to die, she's going to die. You know, they're just relieved you made it. They're relieved you're out of hospital. They're relieved you're not dead. So anything else is a bonus. So they're trying to get people to understand that. And it wasn't sort of communicated with the survivors that I started to realize what thing it was. I was very fortunate in that because I was ex-military, I was fast-tracked to treatment. And I had very good therapy very early on. But I have learned that I am very much in the minority with that, because the vast majority of people, it wasn't prompted by, it wasn't kind of cascaded down from the ITU or my experience. This was kind of separate. So I was like out of hospital and I was on my own, get on with life. It was help that I saw, and I knew that I would be able to access therapy quicker because I'm a veteran.
And I did. And you're medical, so you knew how to navigate the system. Exactly. And you currently have enough cognitive faculties to work through that process. But so many of the survivors, I mean, have severe anxiety picking up a phone, or they can't figure out how to use their phones for months after the ICU, let alone how to find the resources that they suddenly know that they need. They don't know that. And if they mention things to their primary care physicians, for years, for decades, I think, up until recently, they were told, well, only veterans can have PTSD.
I love hearing that. It just absolutely baffles me. And it's, you know, it's just, it's just an absolute lack of even the basic understanding of what PTSD is. Mm-hmm. Okay, veterans are more likely to get it because they're more likely to see stuff and do stuff that's, you know, pretty horrendous. But, you know, anybody, you know, I've got friends who are police officers who, you know, have had experiences and have PTSD. It's not, you know, it's not a privilege of vets. It's more likely to be, you know, diagnosed as in veterans. But, you know, it's a normal response to an abnormal experience. And geez, the intensive care is an abnormal experience.
And then we exacerbate the abnormalities by throwing them away from reality into this horrific alternative reality that's even worse.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in a perfect world...
Sorry, yeah, when I said intensive care, I meant the, you know, the experience that you have in a coma.
And if you could create this ideal discharge process or outpatient support system, what would have helped you as you're walking away from delirium and a medically induced coma?
I think I just should have been assessed. I was earlier on, I should have been assessed full stop. But yeah, people should be assessed more quickly and explained to them why they're experiencing what they're experiencing, that the experience that they are having is not unusual. And yes, we understand how vivid and horrific it was. Because I think if at any point, and nobody ever did go, yeah, we know how bad, you know, we understand how bad it can be. That never happened. I think so. Having somebody who understands what can happen to people so that they are there to kind of give them some information and say, you know, and start signposting them to an appropriate, when they're ready, you know, because that's another thing. I think, you know, people are not ready to start going, entering into and engaging with therapy immediately because it is so traumatic. You know, and I don't think, you know, so they need to be signposted that when they're ready, that, you know, that there is therapy that they can access. Because at the minute, as far as I know, in England, I don't know what it's like in America, but there isn't anything at all.
And people said, well, no one's come back and said that to us. And my thought is, if you're so traumatized, you had no support, you haven't worked through it, why would you go back to the place that traumatized you and be triggered all over again? So of course, there's a huge disconnect.
Yeah, the thought of me going into an entire intensive care unit now brings me out in hives because I know that, and it isn't the intensive care environment. It's not that scary, guys. It's really not. It's just, you know, in fact, it's a lot more calmer and sedate than a normal medical ward is. You know, it's a picture of efficiency, and it's, you know, it isn't that scary. But I just know the idea of would, yeah, so there's nowhere I'd have gone back and said to anybody, and I didn't, you know.
In episode 3, Susan East talked about her 3 experiences with ARDS. The first time she was in medically induced coma, watched babies burn the whole time. And then she went to a lawyer and had documents drafted protecting her against sedation. So wow. If you were given the option again, or you were able to do your own advance directive, which you should, I don't know what it's like in the UK, but what will be your demands moving forward?
I would not be sedated. I think, yeah, I cannot think of anything that they couldn't manage in some way better than sedating me. There just isn't any, you know, one of the things, you know, as I said, when COVID happened and we saw the number of people find themselves in intensive care beds start to rise, and it was very early on in COVID when, you know, information was fairly, was just starting to filter out about what was happening to people. And I remember wife and I, Karen, we were watching the news, and they were talking about how many people would find themselves in intensive care, and the colour just drained from both of our faces. And we just sort of looked at each other. We're both thinking the same thing. What happens if I get it and find myself in intensive care? I'm going to be back there, potentially, going through that again. And Karen's going to be stood by my bed knowing what I'm going through or imagining what I could be going through. I might not, you know, I could be one of the lucky ones who doesn't have any sort of delirium. Because not, you know, not 100% of people do. We know that, right? I could be quite happily snoozing away, but she's going to be stood there for the period of time thinking he's back there. And the idea petrified both of us. So it kind of answers to your question. Anything. I, you know, that has to be the absolute last resort. And Karen knows it. There's no way she,
everyone
there's no
knows.
Way she's
yeah.
There's no way she's gonna let today be.
How fortunate that you have such a strong advocate. Sounds like she did a lot to save your life the first time.
Oh gosh, yeah.
And anecdotally, the Wake and Walk in ICU, their COVID unit, they feel like their delirium rates were fairly low. Which
what's fairly low?
Like they rarely had patients that were delirious. And those that were delirious with COVID were because they had been paralyzed and sedated. And then coming out of, you know, as soon as they could be supine, they had the sedation off. And
right.
Delirious.
Okay.
So
yeah.
When we talk about these high rates of delirium with COVID, let's look at the medications we've given and give it some credit. How much of it really was COVID and how much of it was the benzodiazepines, the propofol, the fentanyl that we were giving just because they were on a ventilator. When we automatically...
Well, that's what they need to be looking at. That's what they need to be looking at. They need to be going, okay, right, these people did, these people didn't. Mm-hmm. What are the commonalities?
Yep.
Okay, commonalities, both COVID. Okay, it can't be that because this group has COVID. What are the commonalities, you know?
Treatments.
But in the treatments, well, we were both put on a ventilator. Okay, this group didn't and this group did. Okay, what drugs were they given? Okay, this group was given it and that group wasn't given it. And this group clearly had the numbers of delirium. Okay.
And I hope we have also survivors coming out and talking about what it was like to be awake and walking on the ventilator and what it was like to be, I mean, like to use the word sedated because it's just the bad word in my vocabulary. And what would you, like if you were to go back and work in intensive care again as a physiotherapist, how would this impact the way you see patients on ventilators? You talk about Karen being mortified by wondering what you're going through, but as a clinician, how should we view patients that are medically induced comas?
I see those are two different questions, if I may. If you'd say to me, if I was still working as a physio and I was working in intensive care, how would I view patients? After my experience, I couldn't. There's no way I would be able to stand there in a ward and see people sedated. I wouldn't be trying to stop the doctors from sedating them. I just wouldn't be able to do it. I couldn't cope with looking at patients and thinking, are they going through what I did? I just couldn't. In answer to what, you know, the other side of the question is, what medical doing differently? I think deep sedation is used routinely to make, you know, it's not as contrived as this, you know what I mean? But ultimately, it's to make patients much more compliant. And that, I think, is not a good enough reason. I think rather than kind of bottoming somebody out with sedation and then bringing them up to a level, I think that needs to be looked at hugely. Because I get that some people need sedating. And I was probably one of them. It was just the level of sedation that's the question mark or whatever. So I think they need to start looking at ways how they introduce sedation from a top down rather than a bottom up approach to the level. That blows my mind that doesn't happen.
It's just we're oblivious to the reality of it. We can't really weigh risk versus benefits when we don't understand the risk.
Yeah. And I think because people are not, because they don't know.
Yeah.
and that's why I'm shouting apparently.
Which I'm so grateful for you being willing to write a book, be honest and real about your experiences, reveal the ugly side, and then come to us in the medical community and hold us accountable. I think
this book isn't a vanity project. If one person reads it after they've come out of a coma and it helps them, then it's worth it. If one medical professional reads it and says, okay, let's not deeply sedate that one patient, then it was worth 2 years writing the book.
That's how I feel about the podcast. I mean, just knowing thus far that maybe a dozen patients have been treated differently because of the podcast makes it, you know, the hours and thousands of dollars, you know, all the things far more worth it. So I think we're on the same mission and I'm looking forward to working with you more closely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you have a website, right? For your book.
Yes. NeverReallyOver.com. And it's available on Amazon. Never Really Over by Aaron Welsh. Yeah. It does come with a certain warning. It's not an easy read, but it's worth it, I think. It sounds really, you know, traumatic, and it is, but you know, there's some humor in there, and there's, you know, I do live and I do get better, and yeah, there's a happy ending to it.
Good. And some units are talking about making this podcast require listening when someone starts working there, and I think your book should be part of the required reading list as well, so that we have a humane, like an actual real perspective on patient care.
Yeah, I think sometimes, you know, it's slap in the face therapy, isn't it? It's, you know, this is what can happen, guys. This is what can happen. This isn't going to happen every time. And if it happens, it's not always this bad, but this can happen.
When I do the webinars, I have told people that I come as like a punch in the gut and then I let butterflies come in. You know, like we can't fix what we can't confront. So we have to realize what we're doing wrong. But I also deeply believe that we can fix this, that we can move forward with a resolve to change and help prevent so much suffering. And that's where the excitement and the joy should come in. And we can humanize the ICU so that we can treat patients as human, see them as human, and watch them walk out as themselves. I deeply believe that. Otherwise, I wouldn't just sit here and dwell on all the harm and the suffering that's happened. It's for a reason.
Yeah, intensive care staff are some of the most highly trained, dedicated, you know, amazing people. You know, I don't want anybody hearing this podcast and thinking, you know, he must be really angry or bitter with the staff. You know, they saved my life and they were amazing people. And I think if they had the slightest idea of what I was going through, they would be mortified because they were such good people.
Yes.
You know, I described the ITU nurses in my book as the SAS of the nursing profession. You know, they're like special forces nurses because they were just so on it for, you know, their 12-hour shift. They were just all over everything. And I think if they knew what some patients were going through, they would be up in arms themselves. We wouldn't even need to do this, I think, if we got the message across to them. I'm plugging my book. If they all read my book, or if they all heard other stories, if they all, you know, if they spoke to some people and they knew what they were going through, they would be driving the change, not us.
Absolutely.
There's no way. There's no way they would let that go on if they knew what was going on.
Especially nurses. I'm a little biased because I'm a nurse practitioner, but I am a nurse forever. And those are the best, most noble, humane people in our society. When they know, not if, but when they know, they will turn this ship around. And I also bear the message that this can be done differently, that most patients do not need deep sedation. And it actually makes it easier for everyone, as mentioned in the previous episode. So we have to know the reality and know what could be and be willing to change. And I think that willingness comes from survivor voices like yours. So thank you so much, Aaron.
Pleasure.
Check out his website. We'll be in contact. Follow him on Twitter. Good things to come. Thanks so much, Aaron.
Thank you very much.
If you want to join in on the conversation, Leave a voicemail at 801-784-0472 or reach out to me on Twitter.